Barbara Rauch. I'm the acting director of the Sensory Computer Interface Research Unit at the University of the Arts. Where's my thing? Oh yeah. It lost the file extension. Why is that?
Is it this thing down here?
Okay. Which one?
Is it down here? I kind of minimized it.
This one? No.
No.
Why did it lose the file extension? Register later. Yeah, what I was just saying, I'm a research fellow in a project called FADE, which is Fine Art Digital Environment. We are particularly concerned with printed surface and really coming from 2D printing issues rather than 3D. But I'm also working with Sclerea Research Unit, where we have researchers looking into collaborative research, science, art-related issues, quite a broad range of PhD candidates, as you have seen today. I might actually just stay in that mode so I can hop a little bit around between the slides, because I put actually probably too many slides in. Does anyone look at that? I have done a PhD at Camberwell as well, and I had my Viva exhibition in a project space called Triangle, and I think maybe those two slides give you an idea where what kind of work I'm doing. I'm using site-specific work. I'm doing video installations, but I also use quite a bit of print technology in my work. This video installation was the first one where I used 3D data to get an idea across, where I collaborated with an artist called Georg Mülleck and a singer, Karin Krog, and actually a team at University College London. They allowed me to use a 3D scanner. So we scanned in a male face and a woman's face, and we had a left and a right screen to then layer different people's faces on top of those two skulls. So we had always composites of faces, never a real existing face, but a combination of someone else's textual data on my face or on George's face. We had also experimented with cellular automata on the male face, so it was a moving cell growth on an artificial cell growth on the skull. That's quite some years back. That was in 2002, I think. We finished the work and presented it in several conferences or contexts in exhibitions. But it has come to a point where I don't want to show the work anymore, because it's quite crude, I think, also from, you see all the holes in the scan that was done in 2002, so we have much better scanners around now. But that's part of technology. Maybe we want to talk about that at some point, what we do with work that was done at a certain stage with a particular piece of equipment that has become obsolete almost. Is that a charming thing, or is it disturbing you, or what are we doing with the works we have maybe overused technology at a point? And then on the other hand, I think we might in 10 years' time then nostalgically look back at the work and think, look at how we came across at that time. So I think it's quite interesting to maybe talk about that at some point. I just have included some of my work to give you a flavor of my approach to exhibitions and visual. Sometimes there's an audio piece with that work. It's a conversation between Rachel and Pandora. Actually, it's staged in the V&A. And they are large-scale digital prints. They hung 10 centimeters proud of the wall. So they create this almost 3D effect of the sculptures. And in the bottom boxes, there is a sound installed. And there is this kind of whispering voices between the two ladies. And it is very much in the style of a chat conversation, an online chat. So it's using the kind of language that we use online when we have small talk. That piece was counterparted with much smaller objects from the V&A to create this community between sculptures there. Another piece where I used 3D scanning, I was using a photochromatic scanner actually back then, presenting different praying positions with my hands, different meditative positions. The piece was shown in Korea, and I was kind of fascinated about a culture that has about 7 or 8 different religious belief systems in the same place, and how it works that they can live with each other. So I wanted to kind of find a visual representation for that fact. I show you a very short video documentation of this piece because this is, I think, the starting point of the work I'm currently engaged with. I called that a work in progress. It is a work where I ask the audience to engage with emotions and facial expression. And I just play you that video. It's short. Don't need the sound. So on the right screen you have a 3D monitor with a fox's face. That was I used Maya to had someone helping me to generate a scanned fox, a stuffed fox, and use the information from the human face. What do we change when we grin or when we frown or when we have a sad face or happy face? So I was actually using Paul Ekman's definition of the universal, 7 universal emotions, and they are happiness, sadness, disgust, fear, anxiety, etc. So I was then on the left screen, you see a human face that has much more subtle expressions, combined emotions like a sad happiness, or where we bring different emotions into one face. And then I had 7 archive boxes where you could leave a story. Could be a dream or a wish or something. You then had to file it into the specific emotion that you thought would be the right emotion. I had very interesting results on that interaction from the audience, because there was someone writing the same story 7 times and put them in the 7 boxes, or a person wrote one story and ripped it apart in 7 bits. And I thought it was really very, very clever interaction with the piece, because there is not such a thing as a pure one emotion.
So you didn't have a box for, I'm not in touch with my emotions, or I don't know what my emotions
are. Exactly. Actually, the piece was just shown in Plymouth. It came down last Sunday in the museum. It's part of the Animal Gaze exhibition that was staged in the Metropolitan University, but then moved to Plymouth and Exeter, I think. just briefly how some of the work was done. We have at Skiria this portable scanner. It's a Minolta scanner. It's a laser scanner. And it is quite stable. Once it's calibrated, we can actually carry it. We don't need to calibrate it every time we use it. But the problem we have at the moment, we don't have a space that is secure enough to leave it up. So when we scan, we need to dismantle it. It takes about 1.5 hours to set it up, and then we have to take it down again. So it's not an ideal way of working with it, because actually you want this equipment to be used every day. You know, that it's... There shouldn't be so much respect, I think. But there we go. And we scanned the fox, and I did then what I showed you on the monitor, on the 3D monitor. I had stills from that little animation that was done in Maya. I left those kind of three-second gaps because I read that it takes about 3 seconds to wipe off an emotion from your face. And I thought it's actually extremely long, 3 seconds, you know, for your enemy to read your face. I think it's enough to have 3 seconds to understand that you are happy or sad about something. While with the voice, we can't lie. We cannot override the sadness in the voice, can't be overridden as easily, unless you're an actor and trained to use your voice. But so hopefully I'm working with a musician on a sound piece, on emotions. So after playing with Maya, I thought, I have to go back to the scanning. I used, instead of using the laser scanner, I used the photogrammatic scanner at the UCL. And it gives me a better texture information. But I also scanned in my volunteer, Jamie, who's the Maya programmer as well. But he can make really kind of a big smile and a good frown. And so he did all that for me. So 7 distinct emotions on his face. And... Peter Hammond from the UCL Dental Institute, he wrote me a software, a really clever piece of software where we just have an X and Y axis where we can morph from any human face showing one of those 7 emotions to the fox's face or the other way around. So I can not only morph from the fox to the human and back and beyond, as you see, but I can also combine any emotion from the human face onto the fox's face.
Why a fox?
Why a fox? It was a mammal that I wanted to start with, but I'm scanning in owls and any other animals. And I was very interested in the evolution of emotions, where emotions are coming from, and... what we project, of course, as humans onto an animal face, like our pets, you know, where we see, you know, happiness or sadness in an animal's face. But I think my interest goes beyond the face, actually. It goes also into areas of gesture, you know, when we make ourselves bigger or smaller, let the shoulders down, or have combinations of head movements when we express something or do this kind of thing. Darwin has done a lot of research into this and you know, has observed animals and humans. And I think it's really coming from there that I'm bringing it together again. But people have, of course, asked me, you know, you should actually scan a moving animal. You know, not a stuffed animal, but that's just accessibility, you know. I wanted to work in the zoo, but then you have to, you know, have much faster, better scanners to do that. But,
So you're saying that you this software allows you to take a kind of happy human face, and that will map the characteristics of happiness onto the foxes.
Yeah.
But are the universal things, you say universal to animals as well as humans, so that will be that would be how a fox in nature is a photograph of a happy fox. That's how it looked.
No, it doesn't.
So I'm wondering if there's this tension, anthropomorphism.
Absolutely. That's why I should actually not scan the human emotion, but rather the animal emotion and bring the animal emotion onto the human face. That would be fantastic, to do that. But I don't have the access to, that information. But I think what happens with the human face, we have developed muscles and physiognomy that is different to a fox's. Mm. So what I'm doing is anthropomorphism, and that's not what I'm interested in. So this is a piece of research rather than where I really want the work to go. But still, I have a lot of possibilities now with the work. I can produce stuff, but is it worth doing? That's the next question. What am I going to do with it? So I'll show you what I'm going to do with it. Maybe I skip that. I have shown some animations of the work at the ICA, I think. Tufts, you have maybe seen the projection that I showed, and I have still in here. But I was interested in bringing it back into physical space, taking it again out of the digital realm into a physical form. And I used freeform at the rapid form at the Royal College. Nick Grace let me use the freeform software and the haptic arm that allows you not only to repair and water tighten your file, it also allows you to do virtual sculpting and get a feedback on the touch of the data. So I messed quite about with using shells and bringing different forms together. You can see the fox's snout and ears coming into the human face. I didn't merely use one form, but I bring different models together. And I kind of got really addicted to it, to using freeform. I at least had to go there twice a week to sit there for half a day and use the tool. But then, what do I do with it? It's extremely expensive to print the stuff, and why would I need to print it? So all these questions kick in, physicality and digital, the digital and the physical and the haptics, of course. Why do we need to produce things? Why do we need to, in terms of sustainability and the mess we create, I did produce this one, and I used the Z-Core printer. We used pigments on one of the head to kind of. I was quite pleased about the results, I must say. I really love the objects. They're extremely vulnerable still because they're only infiltrated with some super glue. But, they're not really. I mean, I can't send them to China for an exhibition. They will just be broken. But, some of these objects, they're a little bit smaller than life size. They're smaller than my face.
Have you animated them?
Taking the object back in.
Have you made a movie?
I have actually. Yeah, I have a still on here. This is what I'm printing at the moment in resin. But yeah, they are stills from an animation.
Right.
And this is the exhibition that is connecting to the conference that we stage on Friday at the V&A, the print surface. So this is another hat I'm wearing. I'm a research fellow in this project where we look into digital personalized surfaces. And this is where I have shown the animations of the piece. So this is a morphing head from the animal to the human being and back, and going from a more neutral face into a smiling man. Was projected large at the ICA, Cafe gallery space. but we also I go really quickly through these now. These are the case studies we worked with over a period of 2 years. And I think maybe Tim's piece, Tim Head's piece, is relevant because he talks directly to the printer. He doesn't scan in any images and then sends it as a TIFF to the printer driver. He avoids the print driver and talks right to the print head and says, put X amount of magenta out. And then he goes to the next editor. So I think he prints about 3 million dots. And he worked together with Ellie Safran at the Slade. Beautiful prints, really. Fantastic. Dan Hayes did some small experiments in using lenticular lens prints, the small prints to the left, and Paul Coldwell did this piece. We had Kathy Prendergast work with us. She did a lot of scanning and painted over the scans and scanned them in again. So it's kind of a physical digital layering process. And I think she came up with quite beautiful prints. And they are off Mount Fuji. I worked with Christian Nold. He's the artist who does a lot of biomapping and emotional maps. Maybe you came across his work. He uses biofeedback systems. He tags people in a community and walks with them the city to come up with emotional maps of a place. So he did San Francisco and Stockport and different cities where he walks with people through the city and sees their arousal and comes up with a visual representation of an emotional city. But for this project, he has actually produced out of an Edgar Allan Poe story, a visual map that uses a tech cloud. So he scanned in the story and looked for the frequency of I think how many 100 words or so, and came up with this piece, which is quite beautiful. It's about a man sitting in a coffee house watching the crowd, and he picks an unusual face in the crowd and he follows that guy. And the result of the story is that he never could really go beyond the guy's face or facade of the face. He never came really close to it. So it's actually quite a beautiful story that Christian wanted to take up again. Probably the most interesting one to discuss today is Bruce Shannon's piece. He's a research fellow at St. Martin's. Did I include some? Yeah, we scanned Bruce's head, which is an ideal case because it's bold. And we did a 3D scan of his head. And he then did half of his sculpture is actually done through a physical rubber mask, and the other one was done through the digital scan. So it was real, kind of the digital and the physical coming almost as a paradox together into one piece. So you might see, the slide through. It's a bronze head, but one is done through a digital scan, the other one is done through the rubber mask. And, all this kind of beautiful hair he made himself out of 3D modeling. And
his
real hair?
It's like on the rubber mask.
It's a Medusa.
It's the Medusa,
and he's got his eyes closed because if you close your eyes to do the process to be cast.
To be cast,
and also if he opens his eyes, you freeze like
He would freeze, exactly.
So it kind of all ties up.
Yeah, and then here he is streaming the tortoise in the hair. That's a long story. I'm sure you will hear him talk at some point. He's actually presenting at the V&A this Friday afternoon. Just briefly, I want to maybe give you a little bit of a an understanding what kind of projects we are doing at Skiria at the moment. I talked a bit about this. I'm hoping to maybe get more collaborators on this project, where I'm looking into motion, emotion, and how technology can contribute to our emotion research. VHIP was a project, maybe you know much more about it because it was done before I really joined Skiria. It was a project where Anshi Giri was inviting students, not only from printmaking, but also from conservation, that is MA in Camberwell, where she allowed, where she wanted to train conservators with the sense on, with the virtual pen, to learn how to scrape off layers of paper, for example. So they wouldn't have to work with an original piece, but could work on a model to train people. But it was actually then used by Paul Coldwell for a printmaking project as well, where he did a piece on virtual printmaking. He said he got terribly sick using the pen, so he hated the whole project when it was over, but it was successful as such. Didn't carry on. Some of you might know James Hawalker. I think he is an artist who wants to discuss how the computer comes to the art studio, to the painter, and not the other way around. So he makes sure that the artist is not dictated by the software, but that maybe the other way around. So he's using a Wacom tablet to do large drawings and paintings. Do I get this right, Tobias?
He's like a missing link between sort of digital and
he's the missing
painting.
Link.
Yeah.
That's how he likes to see himself as well.
Yeah. He's been doing it since about the 70s.
Yeah.
To some acclaim now, but he's been banging away with this ancient technology to help him to produce what are normal prints and drawings, and just kind of bemoans the lack of connectivity between these two.
But I think there is no such a missing link. So we always have fights, so, but it's positive.
His digital, you say he's been at it for years. Is it always been a print outcome rather than a drawn, plotted outcome?
Yeah, and then he scans it back in and then
prints. Yeah, he's a painter.
He prints it back out and paints on top of it. So
the drawing has always been.
It's very much a tool, but just a traditional tool that computer, I suppose, you use in the same way you'd use any other paintbrush or something.
He would probably, if he would have been here today and he wanted to come but he couldn't make it, he would probably talk about the pencil and airbrush and how the airbrush system is an early computer. Mm. And, how people went about the development of the airbrush. Ancient times, so I think
he's got another quite interesting project he's thinking of. He's writing a book about how sort of Victorian and before artists used all these technological means, sort of these sort of strange drawing contraptions, in the same way that we're using technology now. So
the laptop and the open
technology
air.
Hasn't only been around in the last 30 years in art, it's
been. You can obviously map that in terms of 3D imaging as well. More innovation in terms of reproduction of. Scaling up and scaling down and low relief. It's just starting.
He's found all these really completely bizarre contraptions, sort of Sunday painter contraptions that just sort of were around for the fad for a while and disappeared as well. So I don't know what his drawing and analogy is, all the stuff we're using that's going to disappear as well. So maybe.
I think he has connections to you, Kate, as well, didn't he?
Oh, we've had a bit of an exchange because I was trying to find out if anybody else was interested drawing machines in particular.
Yeah.
It seemed that he was predominantly interested in print technology rather than in drawing box.
We can change that. I think he wants to be part of this discussion, so he's going through this with us.
Okay.
Yeah. The same with John had just been awarded now a Leverhulme grant, which is good news. He got a 2-year grant secured working with the eye tracking, and I think quite some of you have seen his presentation last time. So
this guy definitely lends himself to a drawing machine. He's got a whole statistical data of what the computer, how people draw, and you can just build that into a physical thing. You have a drawer, automated drawer.
Automated drawing.
Yeah. I don't think that's where he wants to go with it. He's going with it. So
he's not, but we might.
Yeah,
here, this is on the left, it's Humphrey Ocean, kind of using an eye tracking system. But I think it has several elements to this project. It's not only looking at how an artist looks, it's also a lot to do with face recognition and other elements I think the eye tracking system can be used for, particularly now with the combination of fMRI, that we know what kind of blood flow and what is happening in the brain. And John works with a guy at Birmingham, I think he's mentioned here, Mial.
What's the F in fMRI?
Functional.
Magnetic
resonance. Yeah. Yeah. Blood flow in the brain. I think it shows where the blood flow is increased.
That's where the activity is.
Yeah, where the
so
activity
that's why
is.
They're beginning to be able to say which parts of the brain
are active. Then, of course, you know, there is so many different theories out there. You know, how we shouldn't talk about different parts of the brain doing, because it's a network of information that we use. I think it's an interesting project that we had a tiny little discussion in the morning when we had our coffee that could maybe be much more abused by other people for you know what I mean, kind of using an eye tracker not as an eye tracker but as something different. And I'm sure, you know, there's probably elements that or parts of the machine that he doesn't use at the moment, or not even anymore. That's indicated. I could go on, but I just want to finish with one or two images on this project. It was a project on Henry Moore's large arch at Kensington that fell, had to be dismantled because it was getting dangerous and porous. Let me just get to a point where you can see the arch. Sorry. Here, maybe. Our associate director is John Harrison, who works at the... he's an engineer and works at the Imperial College. And he worked with Angie Geary and the team at the Tate and the Henry Moore Foundation on a two-three-year grant to look into finite element analysis and a structure of large sculptures. And they used the model of the large arch by Henry Moore and produced a digital model of it and looked into the problems that sculptures do have and how it could be avoided by modeling in a digital way where, you know, strengths and weaknesses would appear. So what they came up with, these are the bits, and they were really badly stored. So they at least changed that. This was the maquette Henry Moore worked with. It's a small maquette. Cast in bronze. large problems cast, no problems with that one, fiberglass version. And this is the setting up for the scanning. Actually, they bring in a company to do large-scale scanning of this model to then build a 3D model that could then be tested on finite element analysis tests. Go really smart, quickly. I'll show you just one more thing. Yeah. One of the problems with the large arch was that it was produced in bits. And that was due to that Henry Moore worked with polystyrene models, and they came in blocks. And what he did, he sent the blocks to Italy and got the travestine produced out of the 1-to-1 scale model. And instead of that, the stone people took the stone as it came and looked at the model where it needed strength. They used the blocks as they were. So all the weaknesses come through the breaks of the blocks. And then also the travestine is quite porous as material for large sculpture like that. So what the project was thinking about, would it have helped Henry Moore to kind of get, you know, a virtual model done before he went large scale? But there were several problems to that large arch as well. It wasn't built on a solid foundation. It's just placed into the earth. So it got actually wobbly over time. So that would be the steps they would have to do. Rebuild it in the blocks they needed to be, kind of looking into the weaknesses and strengths of the model itself, but also to have a stable ground. Quite basic thoughts, you would think. Yeah. But, there we go. Okay, that just gives you another flavor of, you know, cultural heritage projects that Skiria had dealt with maybe 4 or 5 years ago, maybe more than we are doing now. Okay, thank you.
You mentioned also drawing project in your list. Did you apply for?
Oh yeah, we did. Yeah, I did. We had a research assistant for 3 years, Mark Hill, who has got a job at Teesside. So he's moved on.
Yeah.
But we applied for an HRC grant and we didn't get it.
Okay.
But we got an A grade. And we can resubmit. So if we do resubmit, I suggest to Mark to put it in as his project, because it was really coming out of his PhD research. And
yeah.
I put it in as principal applicant because he couldn't put it in as principal applicant.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was done like that. But I think if it goes in again, it should go in with him being the principal applicant. And probably he should complete his PhD to, you know, to build it on that. But it was a very interesting project. We want to look into gesture and how artists use drawing and gesture and technology. Wanted to work with case studies, and it was quite a nice project. We had Andy Stiff from MA Digital Arts as one of the applicants, and he's very interested in motion in the city and how drawing is used by architects. So he would have brought in a different approach to drawing as well. And we wanted to work with the Drawing Centre at Wimbledon. They have quite a strong team of researchers. And since we are CCW now, it's Camberwell, Chelsea and Wimbledon School of Art. We are encouraged to work as the 3D college model.
They
have a very good technician called Krishek, what's his surname? Fantastic guy. But I don't think they have much technology, actually. But there is certainly a bunch of people who would be interested in kind of joining us if we would go ahead with something, project, symposia. They have also a good project space. And they usually bring in artists in residency and produce a publication with it, something like a catalog or a fold-out. And maybe we could connect to them and use their space, or some connection could be made quite easily. It's actually Anita Taylor and Avis Newman running that project. Good people. Yeah, that was the drawing and gesture project. And I hope Mark will take it forward.
He's at Teesside.
He's at Teesside, yeah. He's also part of a research team there.
What was his name?
Mark Hill.
Where is he doing his PhD?
At Northumberland. He's in the finishing state since 2 years. So he needs to finish. He's good. Very interesting project. He uses he talks about the ground when you draw, and how in a digital space there is not such a thing as groundedness. It's a fantastic project he's working on. Mm-hmm. The endlessness of space.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, how we can use 3D models, you know, where you can draw on. But he would be interested maybe in kind of coming in this collaboration.
Well, yeah, I won't say very much because my